Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Well, hello again to the cutting-edge pioneers in this vast field of, and at times, morass of mental health and psychology and psychiatry and all the peripheral fields. To those of you who are psychiatrists and psychologists and clinicians of all kinds, social workers, counselors, marriage and family therapists, welcome to the show, as well as consumers and clients and everybody interested in the field. This is the place to come to every week to hear what's really reasonable, what's really true, what's really scientific, what's really empathic and caring. And in the light of empathy and caring, I want to thank all those folks who sent me messages on Skype, and many wrote me by snail mail, congratulating me on my whopping 81st birthday. It's a doozer, my 81st birthday. I don't believe it. But at any rate, I'm in good health. I'm raring to go. And so is my guest, who is a really raring to go guy like me. And his name is Michael Corrigan. Michael, are you there?
I am. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing really good, Michael. Now, Michael's name may be familiar to you in many reasons, in many ways. He's got a marvelous piece on Madden America Today. That's a website. If you're not familiar with, you really need to go and look at www.maddenamerica.org. It's Robert Whitaker created this website. It's his website. It's a fabulous place to find really good information on. I blog on it when the spirit moves me. And we'll talk about Michael and what he's been doing there. But first, I want to remind you that you can actually find out other times Michael Corrigan or anyone, Robert Whitaker, Peter Goetze, anyone has been on the show. If you go to my page first, to Bregan.com, rather than seeking it elsewhere, and we have set up my radio page so that if you just hit a couple of links, you'll get to a place where it says you can also look them up alphabetically. And there you can find an alphabetical list of everybody who's been on the show and when they've appeared. So you can see that Michael's been on four or five times. You can see that I think the person that's been on the most, and it's a lot of it recently, is Peter Goetze, the incredible internist and co-creator of the Corcoran research group, that he's on it. I also want to remind you of a couple of upcoming conferences that I've got going, and you can find these by checking out. Just go to the Bregan.com. It's a marvelously updated page, and look for upcoming events, and you'll find that in November, I'm co-sponsoring a conference with Pam Popper, who's a nutritionist, and I've invited Peter Goetze to come from all the way from Denmark to be there, to Columbus, Ohio, where, incidentally, Michael Corrigan is from, and I hope to get them together there. And also I'll be co-sponsoring with the William Glasser Institute conference in July of this year. So check that out on upcoming conferences. And there I've invited Robert Whitaker. I'm co-sponsoring there, and I've invited Robert Whitaker as my function as co-sponsor. About Michael Corrigan, I admire and respect and care for this man. He's a really, really good man who combines a bunch of really terrific talents. He is, he says, a former problem child who somehow became a psychologist. He's a tenured professor at Marshall University, and more recently he's also been a senior lecturer at The Ohio State University in education and human ecology. He does all kinds of research in child development, educational psychology, research methods, advanced statistical analysis, and we're going to be drawing on some of that today. But don't hang up the phone or however you're listening here. Don't cut off your computer at the idea of advanced statistical analysis. He's going to make this really simple. About a very specific issue. Michael has been a primary and a principal investigator, evaluator for millions of dollars of federally funded studies, published a lot of articles, and he's the author of, listen carefully, he's the author of Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. I love it. Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. It's a great book for giving to people who are trying to face these issues. It's a good book to go along with my my books, including my book on ADHD in kids. He's really, really doing a great job. Now, recently, the study came out, covered in all the, as Michael points out in his blog on, he's got a great blog on Madden America about today's show. A lot of coverage from all the, you know, the major media with this great news. I mean, it's great news. It's going to remove the stigma around ADHD. Kids with ADHD have smaller brains. Yeah, that's really going to remove the stigma around ADHD. I mean, not disgusting that that's how this would be promoted, that here are children with no disorder at all, and now we're supposed to let them live with the fact they have smaller brains. It would be interesting for them to be reminded that people couldn't wait to autopsy Einstein, and maybe Michael can confirm this, but as I recall, what they found when they autopsied Einstein was he had a relatively small brain. Oh, Lord. Listen, I welcome to the show Michael Corrigan. I unleash him to tell you about this horrific study in Lancet, his just overwhelming response and his demands in his article and his demands to just cut this out of the journal and how the journals responded. Michael, welcome again to the show, and I look forward to seeing you in November in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Guy.
How are you?
Doing good. Having you on the show energizes me, so I want to unleash you. The world with truth.
It's the study that Lancet ran in February. They released it. It was just I heard about it from, you know, several people emailed me and said, have you seen this? What do you think? And then, you know, a couple editors emailed me and said that. And then Robert Whitaker emailed me more than anybody and said, you know, do you want to respond to this? And I sat on it for a few days. And I was extremely busy, and I finally had some free time and read all those emails and then read a few headlines that I found on, you know, the internet. And, you know, like you said, Newsweek and CNN and, you know, all these major places, and I'm reading the headlines. I'm like, I just don't believe it. So that's when I sat down and got on the Lancet site, and I had to pay $30-some to get the article. And I started reading the article, and I was just like, for those in the audience and for you, I mean, you know, when we write for journals, we typically have to take a non-biased approach, you know, American Psychological Association, APA formatting, any of the, you know, Chicago, whatever they're writing, you know, requires us to be a little bit more objective in how we present our data and our results. And as I started reading the paper, I was just like, they called it a mega analysis, and they called it, you know, the largest study to date, and this proves that, you know, kids have this. And I was like, how did this even get published? Because, you know, for years I've researched and wrote and been interested in all kinds of different things, and I can't tell you how many great articles I have read published by the Lancet. And then I was just I was just astonished because, you know, I haven't read many in the last year or two from them, but I'm like, where did this happen, you know? And, you know, and as I was looking in there and considering responding to the article, which I'll talk more about, I saw a miscellaneous link showing that they recently, after 12 years, retracted the study they published on autism and vaccines that, you know, led to that whole scare. But it took them 12 years to retract that study. And the more I read and the more I sadly chuckled about the statistics they were claiming to be this amazing evidence and proof of what they were claiming, I just finally agreed to sit down and write that with Robert. And I know it's a long report. They call it a MIA report, Madden America report, not a blog, but it was longer. Robert did a great job cutting it down. I wanted to talk about the fact, I think I spent three pages just starting out talking about that fact that you brought up, is since when do we dismiss decades of research that show us time and time again that the size of the brain doesn't even matter, right? It's ludicrous to publish a paper and not even address that research that exists showing us that size does not necessarily, of the brain, does not necessarily impact how intelligent we are or how quickly we can think. And, you know, I like to joke, as you know, and, you know, part of that, you know, one of the facts I found is that, you know, men's brains are, what, 150 grams heavier than women's, you know, meaning they have a larger volume that creates a larger brain. And as we all know, us men aren't smarter than women, you know, and women aren't inferior in intelligence. And, yeah, the fact that they were just trying to show that the small brain was related to a brain disorder and that identifying the small brain could somehow reduce the stigma just kind of irritated me. So that was my jumping off point with this study. But as I clarify in there, and I've taught research methods for years at the graduate level and undergrad level, and I've, you know, just recently finished teaching regression courses this year at Ohio State, doctoral level, and they supposedly ran regression analyses. They, if you read the study, if you spend the $30-some to get it, and then you have to actually request the appendix, which they've changed since our article came out. I'll tell you more about that. When you read it, it's just, if you know anything about research methods, it was just a horrible study. The people they labeled ADHD, their experimental group, their treatment group, they didn't even diagnose half these folks. And then they also had symptom scores for many of those people that did get diagnoses, but the symptom scores didn't find the same results with brain size as just the fact that they labeled someone ADHD, the label of ADHD or not ADHD. Well, those people that claimed to be not ADHD, their control group, weren't even tested for ADHD. And they weren't even tested for comorbidity issues such as depression or drug abuse or, you know, alcohol or, you know, anything. And that kind of struck me weird when they called it healthy controls. And I started wondering, well, how did thousands of people that agreed to be controls walk into these random 23, you know, brain imaging sites around the world and agree to have, you know, did they get paid to get that brain scan done, or why were they there? You know, nothing's mentioned about that. So, and I could only assume they went in to have a brain scan done for some sort of health issue, and as, you know, signing all the agreements we have to sign when we go into a doctor's office, they, you know, agreed to have their data used. But then, you know, they didn't have any way to, they had like five or six different assessments they used for those they did supposedly test for ADHD. I use air quotes with my fingers there. But their MRIs were not calibrated or normalized across those 23 sites. And that's one of the things we point out in the study, too, is, you know, these people in New York City had twice, one region of the brain had twice the size of their sample in Germany. And it's like, you know, how could you be claiming that those MRIs are assessing, you know, with accuracy across those 23 sites you know, these brain volumes, these different regions of the brain, and yet somehow, you know, folks in Germany have, you know, half the size of the brain. And I think it's, to me, sampling is everything. So if it's not random, if it's a convenient sample, you know, that's a problem. You know, they were there, we used their data, and now we're going to try to act like it relates to every child. And that was my biggest problem with the study. They just try to make, they were so definitive and conclusive that, you know, ADHD children have smaller brains. But, you know, not to get in statistics, I mean, I try to simplify it in the study, but they claim these significant effect sizes, and their effect sizes were extremely small. 0.19, I think, was the largest one they found. And when you, for example, when you take that and put it in real terms, that small of an effect size, that small of the strength of the finding is what it represents. When it's that small at a 0.19, that means you have about a 54% chance of selecting the right, you know, making the right selection that someone has ADHD and a smaller brain. So to me, that they did all these MRI scans, they did this huge study, and it was no more effective than if you pulled a coin out of your pocket right now and flipped the coin. That's all they had, was a 50-50 chance of, you know, that the results are actually right. So if we took in a kid today and had them tested, there's a 50-50 chance if he was diagnosed ADHD that he'd have a smaller brain or not have a smaller brain. So, you know, to some degree, it's just, what scares me is, and you know this, Peter, I mean, you've wrote tons of books and tons of papers, but when you start reviewing all the research out there that's been published, and you really sit down and read these published articles and with a critical eye and an open mind, as I did when I wrote Debunking ADHD, I was just astonished at these were the studies being cited as fact. You know, the studies on pesticides and ADHD, I was just blown away by, you know, just a horrible study. There's just one after another, and the meta-analyses that are being put together using all this, you know, pharmaceutically funded research. And we know full well from tons of stories that have been published that a lot of these are ghost-written. And I think that was one of the other things that kind of struck me strange about the study was there was 82 authors on it. And I think the 66th author was, what's his name, Joseph Biederman? the guy, you know,
who is the great source of under the table money from Johnson & Johnson for pushing drugs on children through the Harvard pharmaceutical group, millions of dollars a year, child psychiatry group.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so, you know, you start looking at this list they had, and the, you know, the conflicts of interest to me were big, but I try to dismiss that. I mean, if you're going to be on that side, you're going to be on that side. You're going to have to say who you are. We're on this side, and we're, you know, unfortunately, no one's paying us millions of dollars to say how we feel. If they did, we'd be able to share with a lot more people. But I think, you know, one of the biggest things is, like, you know, I've published tons of studies that I thought were great about how kids develop character and how kids become better people and how schools can improve things. And you know, no one at CNN picked my story up, you know. and for them to do a study and make all these claims and barely report any data, and just did a horrible job from beginning to end with it, I was just astonished. And I felt I needed to write something. And you know, it got some good feedback, and some major news outlets that we, you know, shared it with and didn't share with it, share our piece with, you know, contacted us asking more questions. But I think that's the biggest thing to me, is how do you stop this propaganda machine? You know, Lancet has this ability to send out a study and put in the right buzzwords, and suddenly it's a headline, you know, on Valentine's Day that, you know, all these kids have smaller brains. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, I was labeled myself a former problem child. I fit probably 18 of all those symptoms of ADHD. So did it hold me back? Did anybody drug me? You know, I meet kids and parents all the time that tell the same story. And, you know, and then I meet others that are just struggling to survive and figure it out. And I think to some degree, when you have this media component that, you know, does these press releases and prints these stories, and suddenly those little clips are hanging up in the doctor's offices they're going into, with the right above the tray that has all the brochures on ADHD and whatever drug they're pushing at that office, we've got a major problem still, you know.
Now, one of the things that you found in reviewing the article, which apparently they now are withdrawing, is when you dug deep into not only having to buy the article, but then having to get specifically request the background material, was that these kids who were, to quote, smaller brains, had higher IQs. So that the headline should have been, kids labeled ADHD have higher IQs. Now, that would have, as you point out, done wonders for the stigma.
Yeah.
They could
exactly
see themselves, as my experience is, they often have higher IQs. I mean, some of them are also, you know, if you're brain injured, you're going to get labeled ADHD. Or if you're very smart and bored, I mean, it doesn't, you're going to get labeled ADHD. It's a meaningless concept. But they tell us about that. They ended up saying, well, that was a typo or something.
Yeah. Supposedly, they state that they unfortunately swapped those two columns wrong, that the scores they provided for the ADHD kids were actually, or for the people, were actually the ADHD scores for the control, and the control were for the ADHD group. So that's convenient. So, you know, the question
so
back was, well, then what else did they switch wrongly?
The ADHD group?
Well, now they're saying those higher scores should have been for the ADHD group. And they mistakenly placed it in there. But the point would be is, and their response, which I just came across today, we don't have to go into it, but they cite one study that says, you know, it's not good to use IQ as controlling statistically for IQ, what we call covariate. And that's just ridiculous, because if we're looking at acuity, you know, if we're in any study we're doing in education, for instance, on achievement, if we have an IQ score, we're throwing it into control four. We're throwing in socioeconomic status.
Oh,
why? Because these are variables that typically could explain what's going on. And we want to separate that effect from what we're actually trying to look at, if it's the tutoring that's working, or if it's the, you know, baseline testing that's working, right?
So they're claiming now, let me get it straight for everybody, that the ADHD group had actually, even though they said higher IQs, now they said they switched columns and the ADHD kid have lower IQs, but it doesn't matter.
Right, right.
Oh, my God. Well, of course it matters.
And lower IQs wouldn't relate to brain size
either. Got retardation or brain injury or something. My God.
Yeah.
It is a form of evil. The world is rife with evil. First, I want to thank you for doing this. This is the kind of work that, as you know, Michael, I used to do a lot of. My books have this kind of work in it. When I was young, it seemed like I was the only person doing these reanalyses of these articles. You're so good at it, and it's – I know it's a royal pain in the neck, but I want to thank you for doing this and debunking it, and because I know it's a thankless, difficult task, but it's important, and I'm glad you're doing it, and maybe you'll be training up some younger people who will take some of this burden off of you and be doing it, but I want to thank you for that.
I appreciate it. It means a lot. Yeah, it takes
Michael,
a lot of time.
Michael, can I go off base here a minute?
Sure.
This is something I've only recently been getting into, but you mentioned at the start that it took Lancet 12 years to withdraw their article linking autism to all the vaccines. And I'm not sure that's an achievement, Michael. I've been talking to folks who have been really evaluating the whole vaccine issue. We give kids now 50, 60 vaccines, folks. And of course, the vaccines, when they're tested and approved, they're not tested with all the other vaccines. They're tested by themselves. Well, what about all the interactions with 60 vaccines? It's so complicated, it wouldn't be impossible to do or to figure out. Furthermore, there's so much horror with the vaccines that the vaccine people decided not, that they weren't going to go ahead anymore and provide vaccines because they had so many lawsuits against them, unless the government set up a special separate court with a few billion dollars in it, I think, to evaluate any cases brought against the drug company, but the companies wouldn't be held liable. I mean, this is akin to what was done. It's not the same, but it's akin to what was done with the atomic power plants, that the, you know, that if those things blow up, it would do the company in. So the federal government is limited what you can sue atomic power plants for if they melt down on you. So I've talked to someone who's reviewed this literature, and they think that the fact that everybody quit the article, except for, you know, one very brave individual who's continued to hold out, is in fact to his credit greatly, and that everybody else did years and years ago, and the fellow Wakefield who has stood by it, they believe is correct. Now, what this means is not what people think, and this is an important confusion. It doesn't mean that these things are causing autism. That's a confusion that even the researchers have. What it would mean if it is true that the vaccines are causing autistic-like behaviors, in fact, they're causing neurological disorders that people are confusing with autism, because autism is not a physical disorder. By definition, by Leo Kanner to begin with, it's a social phenomena of a child being unable to relate to other people as if they're people, with empathy and caring. Very simple, very simple. Autism kids treat other people like they're tables and chairs. They bump them, they bump a table or a chair, not a person. Now, so what's really going on is that due to lack of sophistication, folks didn't realize that the real issue here is, are these vaccines causing a lot of neurological and other physical disorders that are being covered up by the special courts, so that nobody gets the information adequately and nobody can sue the drug companies? And I talked to a person who's very enmeshed in this research, and they said, well, that's actually what is being found, that the vaccines are causing gastrointestinal problems and a variety of other physical disorders and neurological signs. So I just wanted to put that in. This is not an area I've been involved in. But I'm not sure it's to the credit of Lancet that they've finally withdrawn that article. Do you have thoughts about this? Have you looked into this? I'm just dropping this out of the blue on you.
Well, I mean, this was the measles, mumps, and rubella, you know, vaccine. And you know, I know it's a, you know, sticky hot topic these days.
Well, they're very violent. One of the things I'm finding is these companies that support the vaccines, and it's way beyond now just the MMR vaccine. It's about all these 60 vaccines that people are getting, or 50 or whatever the numbers are for individual children, that this group that supports the vaccines is so big, so wealthy, so much money involved. They're meaner than the psychiatry and psychopharmaceutical folks, or at least as mean. So I think this is something I've not spoken out about. It. I'm not claiming to be an expert. I'm telling you what some people have been telling me, who seem to me to work on the same principles of science that I work on. Just throwing that out. You don't have to comment on it.
Oh, well, I just think if studies came out and showed that you could truly state that these symptoms or these issues came from that vaccine and not diet and not genetic and not environment, other environmental factors, you know, if we were able to do that, then I think we could get closer, you know, to supporting a claim that's, you know, in the minority right now. But I think, you know, the problem with so many of these studies is there's not enough control. I mean, we're not working in a vacuum. We're not working in a right. and a psychological laboratory or, you know, a medical laboratory with these children. You know, there's just so many other things that are going on. And you know, we had to make that call with our kids, but, you know, my wife and I, but, you know, I will tell you, I've turned down vaccines that they've recommended. But they are ones I've never heard of. And, you know, right now I don't think it's that important, but to just rule out vaccines, it scares me a little bit.
I have them
and I turned out all right, but
that's not the issue. The issue is the suppression, and the attack on Wakefield, which has been very, very destructive. I think he now lives in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm sure. I can only imagine, but I hate to use the unit of one. I don't mean to do that, but I try to relate things to my world and then try to put science to inform it. But my dad was a longtime military guy, and he used to always blame stuff. He's like, must have been that shot I got during the Korean War, you know, because, you know, when I think about vaccines that are scary, when you hear about so many shots that our soldiers got, you know, going into military battles just to be more resistant to this and that, and it's scary. And you know, when folks go over and get these malaria shots, I've you know known of people who've had very adverse effects to that and nearly died. You know, there's always that chance, you know, that can happen. And I think we take chances with that. So to me, these, you know, vaccines and different drugs that are being provided are, you know, you got a question. And I think, you know, to the greater point is that if we as a society were more aware of what these ivory tower medical papers are actually saying with their numbers and their big words and their, you know, all their different things they use to make it sound so intelligent and yet unreadable to the vast majority, I think we would be better off. We'd at least be more informed rather than basing our opinion on what one media group says and another website says. You know, I just wish we could get to a point where that research was available to people, you know, so they could read it and understand it and not have to pay $30-some to get the article, to just read it themselves. And then, you know, you're thinking, okay, gosh, there's 82 doctors, you know, on this. It's got to be right? You know, but it's not. And it's overstated at the least. It's far overstated. And it's not replicated. And it wasn't a random sample. And it's not even a sample that even relates to American children. You know, that group, if they wanted to say that children in America were, you know, most of the headlines aired, right, because we're the biggest buyer of these drugs, then why didn't they separate that convenient sample out just to look at the children in America and see what that found? Because the study that this group did was on the ADHD brain volumes was, you know, 23 sites and, you know, dozens of different countries. And it's like from ages 4 to, you know, 80 or whatever. And it's like it's not representative of the child we're applying it to, you know, because every article you seem like I read was, you know, these kids, you know, no longer have to live with the stigma. These parents no longer have to live with the stigma. Well, you know, a good part of your sample was over 16 years, 18, 20 years old. So it wasn't a study on kids, you know, in America or kids in general. So they're applying a lot. And that's what my point would be, you know, kind of relates to your vaccine argument. Well, what else did these people do over their lifetime and encounter that might have related to that? And, you know, does it matter? Can we pinpoint that to ADHD? And the fact that they don't have a reliable or valid assessment to diagnose ADHD, and the fact that they don't have a medical test or a blood test or any type of test, you know, related to science to say these are ADHD people, and the fact that they didn't even do any test on the people they claimed weren't ADHD, you know, should throw the vast majority out. So before I'd have to, you know, chime in on the vaccine thing, I'd have to read a few more of them. But from what I read, you know, when I was debating it as a parent, I lean towards the vaccine for my kids. So
I gotcha. this, let's go back to this brain size thing, because I mean, one of the things that was long claimed, of course, by anthropologists was that the black races, who were at the time being enslaved and dominated by the empires, particularly the British and the German empires, that they had small brains. That, of course, hasn't turned out to be true. This small brain issue, I mean, it's really interesting to bring up something like that. And I hadn't thought about what you said, which is the article makes this claim without looking at the enormous literature about the irrelevance of brain size.
Yeah.
I don't even know the simple question. I don't know whether you know it. If you have I'm a small person. You're a large person. I think you're pretty big, aren't you? How tall are you, Michael?
Like 5'10" and a half, I'll give myself.
Oh, I see. You're
shrinking.
Huge.
I'm not 81, but I'm shrinking. So I think at one time I was 5'11".
You're 5 inches taller than me, at least. I mean, you must have a bigger head than me. Don't bigger heads have bigger brains?
You would think, right? That's why they expanded that way. And yes, I do have a big head, Peter. I think I had the second largest football helmet on my high school football team.
Oh, my God. And I had the smallest football helmet. They couldn't even fit me. My helmet used to fall over my eyes so that it impeded my vision when I was charging through the line from my tailback position. And I got criticized for the coach for keeping my head up all the time. But if I kept my head up, I couldn't see out of my helmet. Oh, God, this is so funny. Folks, I hope you're
there's great information.
Folks, you got two guys, one with the biggest on the team and one with the smallest head on the team. Yeah, go ahead.
But, I mean, if anybody listening, just go. That's the first thing I did. I was, you know, I was actually driving. I got the article that day, and I needed to pick up my daughter at school, and I picked her up. And you know, and I've taught about the brain for decades, right? And I was driving home. She's like, you know, what's going on? I was telling her about the story, and she's like, well, that's stupid. We all know that brain size doesn't matter. And, you know, this is my 14-year-old daughter, and I'm like, I forgot about that, you know. And I came home and just decided to revisit it. And, I mean, just in Google, you know, brain size, you know, doesn't matter. And there's tons of studies that show it's just been a mixed bag of claims over, you know, a century or two. And as you said, you know, for years we were going on this information based upon, you know, if they had bumps on their head or face. And, you know, it's just silly science.
Right.
And we've discovered,
you know,
that
it
doesn't matter.
If you look at cross animal studies, for example, I mean, some of the brighter animals have very large brains, some of the mammals in the ocean and so on. But birds are among some of the most intelligent creatures. Right. They can use tools. Parrots can mimic and use tools, a variety of animals. The birds have very intricate social relationships. They have bird brains, right? I mean, they're tiny. So many birds are smarter than larger animals than them. So it doesn't fit. It's about the complexity of the brain and God knows what else.
It's the shiny key syndrome is what I, you know, coin it sometimes. And that is, you know, don't look over there from what we've known and all that stuff. And we're not even talking about it, but look over here with these shiny keys I'm shaking. We have an MRI machine, right? And they use the old MRI tests. These were 5 years ago. You know, they weren't even, you know, using up-to-date MRI machines. So it's just beyond belief.
So what is Lancet doing about all this?
They're not doing anything. They published a few letters that, you know, other people bringing up similar concerns. I don't think as thorough as ours. And then they let the... Martine Hoogman, I think is the author. She's a postdoc over in Finland or something. They let her write a letter. But even in it, she just basically says, you know, she makes up a few excuses for doing it and doesn't even admit that we might have overstated or our language might have been too strong. That's what I would have liked to have seen. You know, You can run whatever stats and report whatever, but as I teach my students and colleagues that I helped, you know, your stats are what they are, okay? And there's limitations to every study. And for God's sakes, just be honest on how strong those findings were and what the limitations were. And that maybe future research is needed to you know, determine what this really means. And maybe there is something here. But don't come out with this study that's got all these methodological problems and statistical errors. They had so much missing data. There's no way they could have ran that study and felt comfortable about it. The results had to have been inflated just because of the missing data they had and the lack of reliability and validity in their assessments, right? But they never even came out and just said, we overstated it. That's what I would have liked to have seen, you know? It doesn't mean that every kid with ADHD has a smaller brain, and it doesn't mean that smaller brains causes the symptoms that are, you know, or behaviors, I'd like to say, associated with ADHD, you know? But they don't come out and do that. And I can only assume is they want more people coming in for brain scanning. And if you read the article, here's something that will drive you crazy. They actually, in the article, make a pitch for this brain research and brain scanning to be a part of the criteria, the diagnostic criteria, and the DSM.
Oh,
so
God.
Even in there, they basically show their cards as to why they're even doing this.
Yeah. I hope you think about republishing this as an article in a journal. There's a few solid journals that would look at this reanalysis. I don't know if you want to put in the effort, but I think it would be worth it.
Well, if you come across any, let me know. But got a fairly busy schedule these days. Beyond
I think Risk and Safety in Medicine, the European Journal, would be interested, Michael.
Yeah, well, email me or give me a call and let me know about it.
Okay. Well, we've got about, 10 minutes left or so, and we haven't planned on what an edition to talk about, but I'd love to hear you just tell folks about what you're doing. One of the things I didn't mention about your talents is Michael is a really artistic communicator. And if you want anybody to do a presentation that will delight, entertain, and educate on ADHD, he does these presentations with all kinds of graphics and cartoons and things he's drawn and stuff. And he does a really great job on presenting for a general audience his ideas on ADHD. So anybody out there that's looking for something like this, Michael's your person, and I hope, Michael, that you're getting to do some of that. I know that there's less and less interest in some of these issues nowadays. It's kind of being a clampdown in the educational community on all this.
Yeah, there's some, but you know, I like to think of my presentations more about child development because that's my area in psychology, and I just try to point out in my studies whether it's ADHD or ODD or whatever they're throwing out these days. A lot of the stuff is just due to trauma. A lot of the stuff is just due to natural, you know, slow, meticulous, painful child development issues, you know, every parent runs into, and we don't have to label it a disorder. I think that's where I know we're hoping the field's going is I don't think we're ever going to get rid of these people that are making billions of dollars selling these drugs and these other folks, you know, getting regular returns from their clients prescribing these drugs. But what would be really nice is if we could make a breakthrough with the insurance industries as healthcare hopefully changes and improves. And that's getting to the point where, you know, why do we have to provide a code number to get, you know, from whichever, you know, book of everything wrong with us to basically get insurance to pay for therapy and treatment and all this other stuff, you know, why do we have to have a code
classes
number to get an IEP or a 504 in schools? You know, why can't it just be related to the challenges of life and the challenges of, you know, sometimes being a late bloomer, you know, when it comes to development of maturation and behavioral issues.
And as you know, probably a lot more than me, it's not just now the pharmaceutical industry, the psychology industry, the testing industry is also playing a huge role in this whole diagnostic fraud, and did from fairly early on. I think I'm right about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of new ones coming out, and they're jumping through all the hoops to do some stats to show it's reliable and valid. But, you know, what they, you know, I think you might have pointed it out before. I know I did in my book, but one thing I discovered when I came across the ADHD symptoms, I'd been doing this exercise for years with my students, showing them how to diagnose giftedness. And when I went through the symptoms for ADHD, I was like, wow, this is a diagnosis for gifted children, you know? And it was just sad to me, because suddenly it was like, okay, no, this is the diagnosis for gifted children that annoy their, you know, parents and teachers, or just exhaust us, you know? So, some degree, the tests that once again they ignore it. When you start really looking at some of these tests, it's like it's not that different from the test to look at this, you know. So it's just silly to some degree. I just think we need to give more resources to parents and more resources to schools to figure out how to, you know, help kids and just get to the point where, you know what, not everybody's gonna always be perfect, and that's why teachers are in their place in heaven or whatever place your religion believes in. But you know, they have to put up with a lot, and you know, being a parent's a ton of work. So, and you know, for most of us, you know, fingers crossed, in my house, you know, those kids turn out to be nice adults, good citizens. And I, you know, that's where my work's been mainly focused in education is, you know, I wrote a book called The Handbook of Pro-Social Education with a bunch of colleagues, trying to get education to the folks in D.C. to understand if we focus on the social side of education, developing kids into better people, better citizens, helping them feel better about themselves and more confident in finding that direction, that dream they want, you know, guess what? Motivation to succeed is going to go up, and when that motivation to succeed and their, you know, the level of affect, the feeling they feel closer to the schools is going to go up, and as a result, your test scores are going to start to increase. And that's what we keep missing with all this new policy. We keep thinking testing is going to tell us something, and, you know, standardized achievement tests haven't told us anything, and I don't think most of these assessments people are using in doctors' offices or clinics, you know, are doing much. And you know, the sad thing is half time in these clinics they have to go through a psychiatrist that, unlike you, feel the obligation to pull out the prescription pad for every one of them and not give a therapist or a clinician a chance to actually work with the child and family for a time to see if they can make progress without drugs. So
Michael, I want to pick up on something that you said in passing, which I think is really important. You said that the same tests that detect ADHD detect giftedness. And last May 30th, I had the honor of addressing the first international conference on intellectual giftedness, which was held in Mexico City. They wanted me to come to Mexico City, but they accepted my doing it by long-distance technology, which worked well. And their theme was why gifted children cannot have ADHD and the dangers of misdiagnosis. And they even gave me a silver medal, genuine silver medal, for my contributions in the area, because what they found is that gifted children are continually diagnosed as ADHD and put on psychiatric drugs internationally, and in great deal in Mexico, where they're very familiar, in the U.S. So that could be one of the most important points to make, is that what looks like ADHD is just often literally giftedness. And my experience of children in my kind of practice, where the kids who were coming and have been diagnosed are not coming from poverty, and they're not coming from, you know, drug addicted families, and not crack babies and so on. They're suburban kids, and or city kids, you know, who have relatively good upbringings and relatively good schools, and really are advantaged. And the ones who are getting diagnosed are often, just strike me as the brightest and the best and the most interesting kids. And
I was going to say that first chapter in my book I wrote, you know, several years ago, was called Drugging Da Vinci, because, and I bring up the fact that these behaviors we associate with ADHD are the same behaviors we use to diagnose, you know, gifted kids. The, you know, the ones that aren't, you know, perfectly behaved and scoring wonderful. You know, the ones that have that skill, that talent, that innate ability, but we just haven't, you know, learned how to nurture it yet. You know, they haven't realized they have it yet. And, you know, we see it all the time. And this year was, you know, kind of a scary year for my third grader, because he had a good teacher, but he was really bored in the class. He's easily bored. He's easily distracted. He doesn't like time tests or any of that, but you give him any type of puzzle or any type of project and he'll work on it forever, you know. And we see it, and we had complaints come home, and it's interesting because I'm like you, I've been, you know, I've helped hundreds of people with their, you know, cases and their issues with kids, and we just kept telling them to just be positive with him and, you know, this and that. He didn't get great grades this year, and the state tests and Terra Nova test came back recently for him, and he was on the 99th percentile for reading, and the 96th percentile for science, 95th percentile for math, and 91st percentile for social studies. And I'm, you know, I had a meeting with the teachers. I'm like, so how do you get a 2, which is not meeting standards the whole year, you know? And the question is we'll take half the responsibility, which I think parents need to do. You know, we obviously didn't make him realize how important it was to pay attention and do all of his schoolwork and really try hard and be that pleasant student. He's meeting standards. He just didn't meet them on those things they gave in the classroom, you know. And I think that's what we run into with so many kids is, you know, it's not a disorder. It's just timing. You know, we just have to give them a little bit more time and a lot more support and a lot more structure. And you know, I guess prayer works for some people. but you know, it just takes more. And, you know, I was just going to say, it's a lot of what my work is now is I'm, you know, working with states and counties. We've developed a new system with Oracle and a company called Helix Business Solutions, where we're helping these folks help kids that are in children's services, helping them in residential treatment, foster care, juvenile detention. That's where my assessment focus is these days. It's called Vital Child Solutions. But to me, I mean, that's where I'm seeing, because a lot of those parents don't have the resources or the ability to go in and have these talks with schools. And a lot of these kids don't have parents, you know, so what do you do for them?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sadly in foster care, it's not uncommon to find these kids on 10 different medications.
Which means they have no chance of learning. Or learning either behaviorally, conduct, you know, improving their conduct, or
or being sober enough to get a grasp on the horrible trauma and issues that have been presented to them, you know. And to me, I mean, we don't, you know, I had a foggy year in college and undergrad. You don't make much progress mentally or emotionally when you are in that fog. And I that's what I see pharmaceuticals as, is it's, it masks the symptoms. It doesn't help us deal with them.
Yeah. And so many things could be like just in a general story, like which so confirms what my experience is, like your son, who's so highly intelligent, but not necessarily quote, performing in school. So much of whether a child pays attention is the quality of the teacher, the individual teacher, and whether that teacher knows how to capture the imagination of that child. I mean, I had classes as a kid where I just taught myself to look very, very interested while I thought about other things. And then I had classes where my imagination was captured for 4 years by my Latin teacher. She's so captured our imagination, we talked to school into giving 2 extra years of Latin. So it's so much about the teacher and the school as much as anything else. And, you know, when you and I address a group, Michael, nobody in the group has ADHD. I mean, I've watched you give your talks, and anybody who's a little sleepy or not watching, as soon as you get up there and you start flashing their stuff on your, you know, that whole system you've got there for entertaining while you educate, and everybody's interested. Everybody's enjoying it and paying attention to it. And I don't use any demonstration things, but if I'm addressing 1,000 people and there's 2 people talking in a far corner, I address them. I ask them what can I do to make it more interesting or whatever. And everybody perks up then, and everybody's paying attention. Well, maybe somebody's hiding under the table. I don't know. So much to do with the teacher.
I agree. And there's a lot that can do a better job, but I'll tell you, until you teach that full day from, you know, ungodly 7:30 in the morning till 3 o'clock at the day, you know, at the end of the day, it's tough to hold
that
attention
for that
long. Well, then it's
the system. Sure, I couldn't do that. So it's the system. Don't blame the teachers necessarily. It's the system, and it's the people who educate the teachers in graduate schools.
That's what we got to change. I mean, when third graders are getting a whole 10 minutes of recess and not allowed to talk at lunch, and 7 periods of 50 minutes of instruction or 40 minutes, whatever, you know, the district, it's silly. It's you're just pouring water into a full sponge. It's just coming right out the bottom, you know, after about 10 a.m. So, that's why I think we could just be doing a heck of a lot more to make them engaged citizens and help them realize what they want to do with their life at an earlier age, to make them realize
Michael,
the value of education.
We're at the end. Michael Corrigan is my guest. He's been on before. Look him up on my radio link on my Bregan.com. And Michael, do you have a private practice where people in Columbus or in the environments can come talk with you?
I don't. My wife's the clinician here, Amanda Corrigan. You can look her up in Columbus if you need some. She's a marriage and family therapist on the north side of Columbus.
Yeah, I would. So, I think that's great.
I'm a charity case sucker.
Because of Michael, and maybe she'll consult with Michael, too.
Yeah, I'm a charity case guy. I just come in to defend people that have had their rights taken away.
Okay. Wrapping it up, Michael Corrigan, thank you for being on the show, and even more so, thank you for what you do out in the world. This is Peter Bregan thanking his wonderful audience for listening to another important hour on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Thank you. Thank you, Michael.